We've got a part one of special two-part interview segment on the Oso Washington mudslide response I borrowed from the files of the Disaster Podcast. So that's coming up, if that's what you're looking for, because you found it right here on this week's episode of the MedicCast.
Transmitters? We don't need no stinking transmitters!
This is the MedicCast, a podcast for EMS providers by EMS providers, featuring EMS news, products, tips, tricks, and commentary. So grab your gear and glove up. Here's today's show with the PodMedic, Jamie Davis.
Good day and welcome to this week's episode of the MedicCast. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the PodMedic, and I'd like to welcome all of you to this week's program. We've got a great show for you this week. I'm bringing you a crossover episode from the Disaster Podcast, which, incidentally, you should all be checking out over at disasterpodcast.com. This episode interviews paramedic Sean Maxwell about the Oso Washington mudslide back in 2014. Remember, an entire section of hillside detached and wiped out an entire residential community. So this is part one of that two-part Disaster Podcast episode. Check it out, it'll be coming right up. Now, before we get to that, though, I do want to make up sure that you check out a couple things. There's links and additional information about this episode over at the MedicCast blog. You can find that at mediccast.com/blog. There's a show notes link at the top of the page. If you want to find this episode, just click it and you can get there that way. You can also find previous episodes if you're looking for something. So I want you to head over there and check out the resources. It's important because I want you to take some time and make sure you follow up on the information you hear me talk about in the show each week so that you understand how it applies to your own EMS practice and protocols. If you have a question after you've checked that out, well, get back in touch with me. You can always do that. Shoot me an email to podmedic@mac.com. You can send me a comment or a question on an episode. Maybe you have an idea for a future interview that the episode kind of said, hey, he could talk about this. Either way, I will get back to you. I respond to every email that comes in, and I'll respond to yours as well. So please keep them coming. Also, don't forget to get out there and get the MedicCast app on your mobile device so you can get the show delivered right to your phone each week. So do that. You can find it in your device's store, and it's absolutely free. We'll go ahead and get on into this week's special episode coming right up. And just a heads up, for all of you watching the video version of this podcast, the Disaster Podcast is an audio program, so all you're going to see during the upcoming segment is the Disaster Podcast logo. So don't adjust your screen. It's supposed to be that way. Well, good day and welcome back to another episode here of the Disaster Podcast. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the PodMedic. It's great to have you all here with me. We've got just another fantastic episode for you tonight, and I'm really excited about it because it's a friend of mine that we were able to finally get on the show, and we've been trying to get Sean on here for a while. We'll talk a little bit more about that here in a second. But before we do that, got to introduce soon-to-be world traveler, my co-host, Sam Bradley.
Ah, yes, that would be me. I'm leaving sunny California to go to a little bit milder weather out in Scotland. And it's the first vacation I've taken in a very long time. And I'm hoping to hook up with some of the EMS and fire folks there and see what I can learn and might even get a podcast out of it. So I'm looking forward to that. And we have Dr. Joe with us. Hi, Joe.
Hey, guys. How are you?
Oh, great.
Things in Memphis.
Absolutely beautiful. It's a gorgeous week of spring in Memphis. Our big music fest is going on, and there's barbecue upcoming next weekend. So it's all good for Memphis in May.
Oh, sounds good. Well, Jamie, you know our guests better than most, and I am really excited about this subject, something a little different than we've talked about before, although we've talked about many disasters, but not a combination of them, and that kind of what happened in Washington. So why don't you introduce Sean
okay.
for us?
Well, we've got Sean Maxwell here with us from, I'm going to make sure I say this right, Snohomish County. Is that correct?
You got it.
All right.
You got it.
In Washington State. And some of you may remember about a little over a year ago, they had a really serious mudslide event that wiped out a whole neighborhood. And they had search and rescue efforts and then search and recovery efforts as a result of that. So we wanted to reach out to Sean to talk a little bit about that response to that particular disaster, but also to talk about how you prepare for something like that and some of the lessons that were learned and adapted. Some of you may also know Sean as an EMS 10 awardee for being an innovator in EMS. And I'm really excited. I got to interview him a couple years ago regarding his checklist system, which he will talk a little bit about in here, because he used that their system used that checklist in their responses, because they help them make sure they cover the bases and don't miss anything in the midst of a high tension, high stress situation. So, Sean, why don't you give folks a little bit about your background, share with us a little bit about who you are.
All right. Well, I'm excited to be on the program too, and honored for you guys to have me. I have a diverse background, I guess you could say. I've been in the fire service 27 years, and I've been a flight medic. I've been a wildland firefighter. I've worked for private, nonprofit ambulance. And for the last 19 years, I've been a firefighter paramedic. And for the last decade, I've been the medical services officer for Somers County Fire District 1. So I oversee one of the largest fire-based EMS systems in Washington State. So we protect nearly 250,000 people. So we run a busy system here, and we do full service. We do all our ALS and BOS transports and first response, and we even launched the first fire-based community paramedic program in the state.
Well, that's awesome. Exciting. I wasn't aware about the community paramedic program. Well, I guess I'm going to have you back on for my medic cast to talk about that in another episode.
Yeah, because we have that going on up here, too. I didn't know there was another fire-based system, so we'll have to chat about that later.
Yeah, well, that part of what we did is we deployed our community paramedic in the disaster situations, too, and so that's a unique part of what we...
Oh, yeah, we'll definitely have to talk about that.
Well, we always like to touch on a little bit of news, and at the time we're recording this, because we're usually a few weeks off on that, when these episodes actually get released. But at the time we were recording this, I live in near Baltimore, as many of you know, and it's just starting to settle down here with all of the unrest. And I know a lot of our firefighter, EMS, and police brethren in Baltimore City and surrounding mutual aid areas have really had a hard time dealing with the unrest and things going on in Baltimore. And, you know, Joe, it makes me wonder if any city is really prepared for that kind of situation, given how Baltimore ended up having to respond so quickly to what was happening.
Well, I certainly agree with you, Jamie. You know, I think it just shows that you can never be too prepared, because you never know what's going to happen and which way it's going to go. And every one of these things are different. This one even had, you know, the complications of violence and, you know, looting and all kinds of other stuff going on top of the disaster that they made out of downtown with destruction of buildings and burning cars and all that sort of thing.
Sam, do you have any thoughts as we think about that? You know, is this something that your system prepares for or sets, you know, looks at, something that they need to be ready to do?
Absolutely. As you may or may not know, the city of Oakland, basically to show support for Baltimore, we had a lot of issues going on there. And that's what I was wondering with Joe, if some of the other big cities aren't getting some of that, I don't know what you would want to call it, just public outcry, cry of support, overflow. Sometimes, you know, maybe it's an excuse just to tear things up. I don't know. But, you know, yeah, I we did have some of that in Oakland. And like you said, fortunately, things are starting to settle down now. So hope keep our fingers crossed.
I know things are pretty rural out where you are, Sean. Do you guys ever worry about these kinds of riot situations in any of your larger towns or areas?
The area I work in isn't actually very rural. We're pretty dense urban, but I responded into the rural areas to help with the disaster response.
Okay. Well, that makes sense. I wasn't aware of that. So that's how we learned. I was always thought you were like out in the middle of nowhere somewhere in Washington State, but need to get my geography down.
I guess that's the way we see Washington compared to where we live. I don't know.
Everything seems so much more spread out in the West that I just look at the West and think everybody, you know, is miles and miles away from each other. But
well, that's somewhat true. Yes. Yeah.
So, Sean, why don't we jump in and talk a little bit about what happened? What events led to the mudslide, and what was the progression of events? Like, how quickly were you alerted, and what kind of happened there?
Yeah. So basically, the setup, it was at about 10:37 on a Saturday morning, on March 22nd. In the spring, the precipitation was about 150 to 200% above normal. And basically 10 million cubic yards let loose from the side of the mountain. And to give you a perspective of 10 million yards, you know, different size dump trucks carry about 5 to 10 cubic yards. So just think, I mean, you know, just think that could be over a million dump truck loads dumped onto a community.
Wow.
And so in addition to that, it also blocked one of our major rivers. So there was a lot of fear on a catastrophic, you know, tidal wave flood shooting down that valley all the way down to the I-5 corridor, which is our main thoroughfare, just the I-5, the same one that goes through California. So
right. That
instantly, not only was there a local emergency, they started preparing cities downstream for a possible catastrophic breakthrough of flooding.
Like we said, one thing leads to another. So what was your day like, Sean? When did you first hear about this? What were you doing?
So, interestingly enough, I was speaking about checklists hours away. it was funny. People in the classroom started getting texts and news alerts saying there's been a mudslide. And it was one of those slow-moving forces that it really built. You know, the different 911 calls coming in, it just kept growing and growing from every level, every emergency responder trying to get their heads wrapped around how big this was. And it really was, it felt like over the next 24 hours, people grappling with the side of a hill had just come down because we just don't deal with a lot of mudslides.
Yeah. At what point did you know it was a really big problem? You weren't even in the area then when it hit, right? You were elsewhere.
No, I wasn't actually. I wasn't. It was a situation where it was just this building structure, and I would say one of the very first lessons learned is I think all of us in the emergency services, we have a certain kind of courage that, you know, we can handle it no matter how big it is, and we're very cool, calm, and calculated on pulling the major triggers. And I think everybody was pulling those major triggers, but I think we need to be pulling even, it just kept getting bigger and bigger. And part of that wasn't just the initial response, it was the response effort, because in the end, I think it was a 100 different local, state, and federal response agencies and volunteers with up to 900 people. So the event just kept growing and growing, and trying to stay ahead of the infrastructure of such a large response, I think was challenging.
I think you didn't have triggers that big, because who would have anticipated something like that, right?
Right, and what you guys were saying earlier, it was in a very austere environment, very rural in the environment. They had to bring, I didn't know what it was called, a cow, which is cell on wheels. They had to set up cell service so we could communicate. So they brought in portable cell towers just because of the remoteness of the area. And and we needed to be able to communicate with cell phones and radios up there.
Yeah, you lost power up there for 9 days.
Yeah, I'm sure at least. I don't know the exact amount of time they lost power for that event.
Yeah. You know, Joe, we talk about this, you know, hearing Sean describe it firsthand from his perspective. You guys always talk about that this is a once in a lifetime event, you know, once in a career event. And when it strikes, it is overwhelming. And that's what I hear Sean talking about, is that it just kept getting bigger. It was rapidly determined that it was going to overwhelm the system. No matter what they kept adding to it, it just kept growing.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right, Jamie. You know, a lot of us at FEMA had an IST out there and several task forces at work out there pretty quickly. And, you know, I think it was part of the conversation we had at a recent training event that we did was the issues that folks on each side of the mudslide were having, not able to communicate with each other across the mudslide and trying to figure out what road was going where and how you could get access around the mudslide and just the tremendous confusion and disorientation when all the landmarks were lost by that massive amount of mountain that literally rolled down the valley there.
I can imagine getting equipment in and out was a challenge.
Oh yeah, they actually built roads. They built roads overnight. I mean, considering the circumstances, the response is truly a model response in when there's no playbook and you're creating the playbook as you go. I mean, I think that it was an incredible response. I do have to put in a plug for the FEMA IST team. Dr. Bradley came in, and that doctor has so much experience. He said he used to run in President Reagan's motorcade, and he'd been to 9/11 and Katrina. He had been all over the place. But since there was no playbook on this, we were having to create the rules as we went and the strategies. He said this was like taking World Trade Center steel and then pouring mud on top of it when you figure all the logs and debris that we are trying to search through. And
so
I've never forgot that analogy he gave.
It makes sense. So, Sean, how many people were involved in this in terms of illness or injury or people lost? I don't have a concept of that.
43 people were lost in the slide.
Ouch.
And it basically knocked out an entire neighborhood, just basically wiped it off the face of the earth. Nobody was rescued alive, I think, by after nightfall of that first day.
It's Saturday morning at 10 o'clock was probably one of the worst times this could have happened, because if it had been middle of the week, a lot of people would have been at work, presumably. But it's just such a tragedy. And I remember, the coverage of it and thinking about how you apply things like incident command structure and things like that. But it sounds like the lessons and preparation that you guys had put in place for other things did stand you in good stead, that you were able to apply parts of what you had to create the playbook, as you said.
Yeah, when we have a regional incident response team that came in and started setting up, incident command and working together. And so that definitely helped set us up with some structure. And even the people that respond from FEMA said they said, in so many disaster situations, there's turf battles and disagreements. And they said they're actually shocked at the collaboration and how well everybody, whether it was the public or the federal assets or the local assets, everybody just, they said, came together in such a unique way and really worked together well.
Awesome. So you say most of the people, unfortunately, weren't able to get out of their homes when the mud came down, but were there injuries as well? What, can you talk a little bit about the EMS response?
There, you know, it was, there was just, the injuries were interesting. I mean, there are a few people that were cut, literally cut out of their houses with chainsaws that had been shoved into different parts of their houses. You know, there were definitely, you know, orthopedic injuries and general traumatic injuries. And then there was a one child, and there's a video on YouTube out there that's not too hard to find, that somehow was either popped out of the slurry or rode the slurry on the top. And there was a young child sitting on one of what they called the hummocks, which kind of looked like these moonscape knolls out through there. And one of the rescue helicopters was able to pluck him off of one of those hummocks. So it was, most of the people were caught in just that massive amount of energy and trauma, and just didn't make it.
How much warning do you get for something like that? I mean, how fast did that mud, you know, I'm somewhere between water and lava. How fast does mud actually travel?
This was one thing where the geologist said that this was more destructive and faster and deeper than anybody had ever seen before. There was one geologist that said, you know, he would have been on the road watching this come down. He probably would have stayed there and taken pictures, and he would have been killed in it. He had no idea that it would travel that far and that fast. The whole thing was just over in a matter of seconds. It was just so fast.
Wow.
And there was no outrunning it, or, you know, if you were caught in it, you were stuck. It was that forceful.
Oh, absolutely. It was instantaneous. It literally picked up cars and threw them, you know, just over trees. It was the amount of energy was inconceivable, and I think before this, they had never perceived that it would be that strong.
Well, that child sure had a guardian angel.
Oh, well, amazing. That's just amazing. Yeah.
That's a story that'll go on for years when he's an adult. Yeah. That's what he'll be famous for. So, Joe, I've got to wonder, I don't know if you've ever involved yourself on the USAR level with an event like this, but what do you do? I mean, how do you get in there and start digging?
I think Sean, you know, hit on that pretty well. It's all about cooperation, you know, from a federal side. I talked with Rich. He's a good friend, and you know, got not only some personal insights from him, but we spent a fair amount of time reviewing that response. And you know, I think that cooperative spirit there really made a huge difference in how things got started. There were some really interesting stories about the challenges there, I think, of sort of dealing with the public to some extent. And that really had to do with some plotting that was done in conjunction with the U.S. Geospatial Intelligence Agency that FEMA works with pretty closely and are pretty much deployed with us whenever we're in the field. And they were able to actually do, you know, satellite imagery, et cetera, to plot out a couple different things. One was the expected location of the remains of those that were killed, and actually to, using some very cool technology, be able to show the depth of the soil that was in place where those houses used to be. I believe it was 22 feet, if I remember right.
Wow.
Of soil over where those houses used to be. And as they begin to show that to, you know, public representatives and the public, obviously the public was, you know, concerned because, you know, the house of my, you know, fill in the blank neighbor, daughter, whoever, you know, was up on the hill and it was way up that road and you guys aren't even up there. and why aren't you looking for, you know, my loved one? And they were able to show them that, you know, the house was completely gone. It's under 22 feet of rubble. And all of the debris from that site was 2 or 3 miles away, down near the front edge of the slide. And once they plotted that stuff out and got permission to begin searching in those areas, the recovery efforts sped up pretty quickly. And by that, I mean the ability to actually find remains moved along much more quickly. So it was, you know, I think that could not have been possible without all the local responders who were there, the state geology people, the FEMA folks, the folks from the intelligence agency, et cetera. So it truly was a very combined and cooperative response that allowed that process to move forward.
So, Sean, did I hear you say there were something like 100 agencies involved? I mean, that to me is astronomical, that you can take that many different agencies at the local, state, and federal level and have them work so well together. That really speaks well of when it hits the fan, we can do this.
Oh, yeah. I mean, many of us talked during that. I mean, it should be a model of how things work together. And people weren't used to it because a lot of the incident command teams, I was up there for 5 weeks, would start to rotate, just like our National Forest Fire System. They were bringing in Forest Service incident commanders in the springtime who had only fought forest fires and putting them in charge of a mudslide. And they would adapt, and everybody else would, you know, say, you know, you're the division lead, and we've been here for a few weeks, but we're going to pop you up as our incident commander for this division. And the Forest Service people would adapt and do just a great job too, even though, you know, they're used to fighting forest fires.
Semper Gumby. You got to be flexible.
Absolutely.
Well, another thing I'm wondering about too, Sean, is when this first hit, was there a lot of public hysteria as far as, gee, what's going to come down in my house? How did they deal with that?
Working with the media and everything was absolutely key because this whole valley, they were able to do, the geologists were able to, I forget what it's called, but they can look at the surfaces years and years back and look at, and they realized the entire valley was made up of the same kind of slide potential as what came down. So there was even fear for the responders working out there. So they actually had geologists out there all day long with spotters monitoring the slope for any type of movement. Not only from across the valley, they had spotting scopes and they had their seismic equipment, but they'd also send people up to the side of the bluff that had broken free, and they would take measurements every day, all day long, monitoring for the rescuers that there wasn't a secondary slide.
It will sound similar to what they do in an avalanche. I mean, it's a different substance, but I guess there's some of the same principles there, right?
Yeah. No, that's a great point.
I just got this mental picture because that's what they do, you know, when they're testing to see what an avalanche potential might be. So that actually makes sense. Because, I didn't think about the fact that all of those people working there had to worry about more of it coming down. That's pretty scary.
Well, and it brings up, again, we've talked in the past about security for the responders and safety for the responders. And, you know, we've talked about places like Haiti and places like Katrina, and where the security concerns were much different than they were here, but they were no less severe. It was still a secure event. We just had to provide for that security in a different way. Sean, would you agree?
Yeah, absolutely. And we dealt with all sorts of other things. There would be different bloggers and stuff also trying to pose as rescuers to try and infiltrate into the scene to get pictures and write about their blogs too. So there was that kind of security also that everybody was trying to deal with.
That's hard to believe. I guess it isn't. I mean, It's one thing to want to disseminate information, but to put yourself or someone else in danger to get it, that's kind of scary.
Yeah, well, it was real and it was happening, and it had to be part of what we dealt with out there.
Well, I guess there's always that morbid curiosity, you know, I got to go see the worst thing that happened. But I'm curious, too, what's it like today? I mean, how long did it take the process of cleanup until, you know, all the bodies were recovered? And I don't know, were they planning to do any more with it or just leave it the way it was?
You know, there's still talk on that. You know, do they make it a park? Do they? We obviously in March we had a big we brought out the honor guard and did a big 1 year memorial service out there. So, and I know there's lots of people still dealing with the grief of it. Not only the community members, but I think it for some reason. It took a real toll on the responders. I think because it was such a long response, it's tough. I think to search for remains for that long with that kind of destructive force.
Well, that brings up a good question because we talk a lot about, like Jamie mentioned, responder safety and managing their mental health during and after these incidents. How is that being dealt with in Washington?
So that's another. That was another aspect we learned about. There's an agency called the Green Cross, or Academy of Traumatology, and they're volunteers, and they mobilize from across the nation and respond in. And they were great. So we had the Green Cross really going out and checking on responders, and then we kind of did a chaplain mutual aid response from across the state. So there's state patrol, fire chaplains, sheriff chaplains, all kinds of chaplains that came in, and we really had them, they were out on the scene, really checking in with people and trying to touch every person as they went on and off the debris field, as we called it, because there's definitely people breaking down from, I mean, it's the trauma of the response, but people were working grueling hours. You know, we'd start briefing at 5 a.m. and sometimes you wouldn't get home till 10 o'clock at night if you went home. Some people just threw out a sleep bag and stayed at the camp there too. The other thing was learning that in EMS, so I was overseeing the EMS response, you know, there would be people really struggling on scene, and you'd get a report of a volunteer rescuer struggling on scene, and logistically it was hard to get around, but you would actually be trying to respond to an area where maybe a family member or a volunteer or a rescuer was really struggling and really breaking down, and the other responders are noticing it. So you're actually doing a mental health emergency response, if that makes sense.
It absolutely makes sense. And this part of it reminds me very much of Ground Zero, about, you know, this place and all the people around it and on it and all the long hours. It just reminds me very much of having spent a couple of weeks there. And the fact that these things don't go away in a minute or in a week,
right,
or in a month. And there's always that long-term need to check in with people. And there may have been those who said, you know, it's time for me to get out of this line of work and go do something else.
You know, and Joe, we've talked about this with you as well in the past, that ongoing response need to monitor the health and well-being of your team, and how you've noticed in the past that there are nagging little things that start to creep up and give you a sense of, you know, when the complaints get to this level, or, you know, somebody starts having this going on or that complaint going on, that they need to have a break off the hill or a break off the debris field or whatever the case may be.
Absolutely. You know, it requires everybody watching after everybody else and making those tough decisions that it's time to pull this person away, which can be really challenging because obviously they're there and they want to make a difference, and they feel like a failure, and they're, you know, they're letting their friends down, etc. So those are pretty tough things to do.
Yeah, you guys are 100% right on. I know that they took down every responder, and I can't remember if it was a few weeks or a month after, but I did get a phone call. They had a crisis intervention team member actually f- follow up with every responder. I think it was a month later to check in with them. And I thought that was a really good effort on the part of the incident commander setting that up for everybody. And I know, even though we had just the most incredible response from around the nation, it really started to tax. We were rotating just tons of our first responder crews out there. But towards the end, there were people that, you know, their chief was saying, you know, my department just can't rotate people up there anymore. You know, you're getting into a month or so, and you're still having to maintain regular emergency response operations in your agency. Yet it was still requiring just such a huge show of force up there. So it was challenging towards the end on stretching everybody to the limit to keep people up there to be searching for people.
So how long did that effort actually go on before you said, okay, we've done as much as we can do out here?
Well, they kept searching, and they found everybody.
Oh, wow.
They kept going. They made a commitment, and they kept going.
Boy, that sure sounds like ground zero too.
Yeah. It was about five or six weeks. And I know you guys are saying there, it was 28 feet deep, but if you looked at it in some places, it was 70 feet deep. Just talking to geologists up there, they said they would be studying this for a long time because it changed their paradigm of what they thought was possible with these kind of slides.
I can imagine.
It's hard to be the test case for that, though, Sean, I'm sure. You know, you don't wish that on any community, but it just goes to show you. One of the things we talk about a lot here is that you can prepare to a point for these types of things, but you can't be prepared for what's going to happen when it happens, because it will be something unexpected.
Yeah. And I, you know what I would say is, you know, one of my takeaways from this is nobody expected a mudslide. Nobody, I mean, there's going to be other disasters that none of us have conceived, but it really comes down to, you can't prepare for something specific, but you can keep stretching your mind to improve your creative capability, because that's what it comes down to. How creative can you be to keep adjusting to the response and adapting to the response?
Well, and of course you did have lessons learned, I'm sure. Do you have a checklist for this, should it ever happen again?
Yeah, I do. See, that was a really interesting thing too. And it was challenging. I felt I would get frustrated because I would start at 5 or 6 in the morning, and we had crews rotating off different medic units. We created a thing called spike medics that we had done in my wildland firefighting 20 years earlier. We had the FEMA doctors and paramedics. We had National Guard doctors and paramedics. Eventually they put us in charge of the veterinary response, the mental health response. We had all these different aspects. And so you would have tons and tons of people, and they would be rotating through. So eventually we did have to create a checklist on everything that they would need to be briefed on to understand how we were going to respond if there was an emergency, and have everybody from all these different agencies who are rotating people through on the same page.
Well, that makes perfect sense, because you have all these different people rotating in. You need to have a plan. That makes great sense.
Right. And it was, you know, do we hoist people out? Do we ground people out? Because we had very, you know, one of the unique things we did out there is you would literally, it was a slurry. It would look like you're on solid ground, and all of a sudden you would be up to your waist and sometimes up to your armpits buried in the mud out there, and you couldn't even see it coming. And ooh. So... one of the things that I think was really unique out there is we would have to take these wooden I-beams, and we would create pathways to get around on this, you know, acres and acres, you know, mile-long debris field. And so I started to coordinate with the National Guard, who I will use them for every disaster from now on. They are amazing. But we would coordinate because all the excavators would move the slurry, break up pathways. And every morning we would make these plank pathways from one end of the debris field to the other where we were operating. So if somebody was injured, we would be able to evacuate them. So our plan was to have Stokes baskets, basically where the plank pathways met the road. And then we would take what I'd done, spike medics, and spike medics would be able to do a cricothyrotomy, give pain meds, start an IV and give fluids, and they would also have a tourniquet. So they would do whatever it would take to keep them alive for 5 or 10 minutes. And we would activate the National Guard, who would race in with a Stokes basket on these plank pathways and provide the people power to put someone on a Stokes basket and move them off the debris field, because there was no way you're getting them off through the slurry. You had to have these plank pathways intact all the time as evacuation routes. And then there would be an ambulance waiting there for them to move them out to a remote LZ, because one of the first times I got a helicopter in, a door flew up because you've got cars and houses in there, so it was not a safe place to hoist people off of either. So that was something we had to set up every single morning, an entire plan to evacuate responders.
Wow, what do you think of that, Joe?
Well, I remember actually hearing about that story, and excuse me, I remember us talking about that as kind of almost the best practice model in a lot of ways.
And you know what? We're going to break this episode in two, folks, and turn this into a two-parter. Sean just had some amazing stuff to relate to us about the continued efforts of response and some of the lessons they learned from this. So we're going to go ahead and close out here. But, you know, Joe, it just tells me that the important things and important work that Paragon is doing, as you know, you're our sponsor and we really love that you guys sponsor our show, but we also love that you guys are out there preparing people to do this kind of important work when these disasters strike.
Yeah, we're really, really pleased to be able to get out and offer that training to folks. And it's so incredibly satisfying to talk to folks like Sean who have been there and done that, and how those principles continue to appear, and makes me think that we're doing something right.
I definitely think you are, and I can't say enough about it. Folks, you need to head over and check out what's going on with Paragon. Try to find out when you can get to one of their training events, or better yet, find out how you can work with your team in your area to bring them in and do a training. And I'll tell you, they seem to be proving again, time and again, Joe, you guys, no training event is too small. You just did an event in Florida a couple weeks ago with, 600 and some people?
Yep, just over 600 people.
That's amazing to me. And I know you guys were really tired, but 600 students rotated through a training program in, 4 days?
Yep, absolutely.
That's amazing.
Well, it was awesome.
Yeah. Joe, so where can folks find Paragon if they want to find out more about what you guys are doing?
So please come visit our website at paragonmedicalgroup.com. And you can also find us on Facebook under Paragon Medical Group. Look for us on Twitter at ParagonMedEDU.
And Sam, where can people find you?
Well, just a thought too. I gotta think an episode like this is something that Joe actually gets something out of. I could see him taking little notes on, gee, we gotta add that to the training, because when we learn about these unique situations, that's just something else he can say. He can help people become prepared for, which is awesome. I'm in the usual social media places at Sam Bradley or Sam Bradley 11, and most certainly on the disasterpodcast.com website, where we hope you enjoyed this enough to come over and make some comments that Sean can answer for you, and let us know whatever else you want us to talk about. Is there something we haven't thought of? This is something that isn't as well known as I thought it would be. So maybe there's other things we need to know about out there. And Jamie, where do they find you?
Well, they can find me under the handle PodMedic in most social media places. And of course, as well over at disasterpodcast.com. And, you know, continue, come back next week. You've got to hear the rest of what Sean had to say about the response, the lessons learned. He talked a lot about the dealing with the rescue dogs and the having to do animal health in this prolonged response. So if you're interested in that, you might want to stick around and catch next week's episode. Just amazing. And leave comments, folks. Head over to disasterpodcast.com and just say hi. Tell us what you like, what you don't like. Leave a message for Sean and support any of our guests. You know, we bring on actual responders, and it's not easy for them to do the jobs they do, or even sometimes to talk about the jobs they've done. So a show of support is always welcome, and thanks for them sharing their stories is appreciated. That's it, Sam. You know, we're going to learn a lot more about this, but definitely the lessons learned in Washington State from this event have taught us a lot about disaster medicine.
You do not want to miss this one, because if I think more than any episode we've ever had, this shows that disaster medicine is not our everyday medicine.
That's going to wrap up this week's episode of the MedicCast. I want to thank all of you for checking out the show this week, and of course, remind you to follow up on all of the information you get in this week's show over at the MedicCast blog. That's at mediccast.com/blog. Over there, you'll find a show notes link at the top of the page. Go ahead and take a moment and follow up on all of the information and links to news items and more you find there each week. You can also sign up for our email newsletter that'll bring you those links directly into your email inbox each week if you want. There's a form on the right-hand side of the page. Just go ahead and fill that out, and you can get the MedicCast newsletter for yourself. I also welcome your comments and suggestions by email. So if you want to get back in touch with me, shoot me an email to podmedic@mac.com. Send in your ideas for news links, ideas for future show topics or interviews, whatever comments you might have. I really do look forward to hearing from you, and I'll make sure I get back to you. I work hard to respond back to every email that comes in, so please keep those emails coming. If you want to catch up with me on social media and some of the pages and sites out there, you can find me at most places under the handle PodMedic. So you can catch me over at Twitter at twitter.com/podmedic or Facebook at facebook.com/podmedic. Friend or follow me over there. Also, don't forget to check out our MedicCast Facebook page. We now have over 5,000 followers, so head over to facebook.com/medicCast. Click the like button on the top of the page and join the community over there. That's going to wrap up this week's episode of the MedicCast. Please make sure you spread the word and share the MedicCast with your colleagues and students and friends in the EMS world. I'll be back here each week with new episodes, new interviews, news items, tips, and more every Monday morning to start off your EMS week. Tell somebody else about the MedicCast today. I'm Jamie Davis, the PodMedic. It's time to close out the show. Don't forget to thank our sponsors, and remember, folks, Scene Safety, BSI.